Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next half hour segment, we're going to proceed with an update of matters German, and in particular, German corporate acquisitions in the United States, and the continued progress of German fascism, the recent election of a center-left government in Germany notwithstanding. Before the break, after a review of the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, I talked about and its significance for corporate Germany. I talked about the book Serpent's Walk, a Nazi tract put out by National Vanguard Books that talks about a Nazi takeover of the United States in the mid-21st century by the descendants of the SS, who build up a huge flight capital organization and then buy into the American opinion-forming media, infiltrate the U.S. Army, and take over the United States. Of course, the Bormann Flight Capital Organization is a reality, and that's one of the reasons why when I read Serpent's Walk, I was convinced that this was not the novel it purports to be, but rather a manifesto, a blueprint for what is actually going on. Just before the break, we read an article from the San Jose Mercury News of Wednesday, October 7th of 1998, about Bertelsmann AG's acquisition of BarnesandNoble.com, increasing Bertelsmann's preeminence in American and English language publishing. And after that, we read a statement by the American Booksellers Association that was made on the American Booksellers Association website of www.bookweb.org, in which they spoke about Barnes & Noble, now with strong capital relations with Bertelsmann AG, Barnes & Noble's acquisition of the Ingram Book Company. Between Bertelsmann and its relationship with Barnes & Noble and the von Holtzbrinck Company, the SS-connected von Holtzbrinck Company, they now dominate American publishing. And what educated Americans are going to know about the world is going to come from corporate Germany. Again, bearing in mind the Serpent's Walk scenario in which the SS capital organization, basically the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, buy into the American opinion-forming media as a key component of their taking over the United States, and bear in mind, again, the relationship between corporate Germany and the underground Bormann organization, and bear in mind Bertelsmann's consummate role in American publishing now. Also bear in mind the von Holtzbrinck Company's significant role that I discussed in German corporate acquisitions in the United States. The founder of the von Holtzbrinck Company joined the Nazi Party 2 years before Hitler came to power, and reportedly employed large numbers of SS men in several of his companies after the war, strongly suggesting the connections to the Bormann Group. More about Bertelsmann's continuing influence and growing influence in the American market. This from the New York Times of Saturday, November 21st of 1998. This is an article by Doreen Caraval, C-A-R-V-A-J-A-L. It's headlined, Bertelsmann Signs Deal for Springer Verlag. That's S-P-R-I-N-G-E-R hyphen V-E-R-L-A-G. Subtitled, 82% of technical publisher offers new inroads into U.S. market. And this reads in part, the media conglomerate Bertelsmann AG deepened its wide-ranging investment in books yesterday, signing a $1 billion German mark or $597 million deal to buy a majority stake in a top international publisher of scientific and medical books. The acquisition will allow Bertelsmann to make new inroads into the United States market. The deal is for 2%. The deal is for 82% of Springer Verlag GmbH, Germany's biggest publisher of scientific journals and technical books, with headquarters in Berlin and operations worldwide. Skipping down, the purchase is the latest in a series of highly visible acquisitions by this German conglomerate, which earlier this year took over Random House, the leading American trade publisher, and in October struck a deal with Barnes & Noble to participate in a joint venture in the chain's online bookstore. And I would add that Barnes & Noble, after forming that capital relationship with Bertelsmann, then purchased Ingram, the largest book wholesaler in the United States. Continuing, almost 25% of Springer's annual revenues of 615 million marks comes from the United States, where it has a flourishing publishing house based in the Flatiron Building at 23rd Street and Broadway in Manhattan. More than 60% of the company's publications are in English. Bear in mind that the von Holtzbrinck Company that I spoke about in German corporate acquisitions in the United States now also owns Scientific American. And again, what you're witnessing is the Serpent's Walk scenario coming to pass. One of the reasons also that I, when I read the book Serpent's Walk, I came to believe that this was not the novel that some would have us believe, was that there are indications, too, that in addition to the Galen spy organization that was grafted onto the U.S. National Security Establishment at the end of World War II, as were the Project Paperclip Nazi defense scientists, that there indeed was an attempt, and this attempt conducted in connection with domestic American fascists, to form very close relationships between residual Nazi elements in Germany and the United States Army. I have alluded in other broadcasts to Professor Wilhelm Stauffer, who a pseudonym for a person who runs a consulting service that specializes in German affairs and has an anti-fascist perspective. I interviewed Professor Stauffer over a period of months in 1993 and 94, and those tapes are available from Spitfire. And Professor Stauffer, who had considerable intelligence connections, maintained that in fact for years, for many, many years, Nazi elements in Germany had been forming very close political and economic relations with American service personnel and their dependents stationed in Germany. And that in fact the Underground Reich, something well known to Professor Stauffer, had actually formed a fifth column within the American military. They're not loyal to the United States, but loyal to Germany in the Underground Reich. There are indications that that a move to create just such a fifth column in connection with two prominent American fascists was already underway by the mid-1950s. For information about this, we're going to turn to the book The Man Who Knew Too Much, authored by Dick Russell. This is arguably the best and certainly the longest book about the assassination of President Kennedy. It was published in hardcover and softcover by Carroll and Graff, C-A-R-R-O-L-L, and Graff is G-R-A-F, copyright 1992. And the two prominent American fascists who were discussing in the mid-1950s in their correspondence about how to form close relationships between German elements and the U.S. Army or U.S. military personnel and their dependents stationed in Germany were former General Charles Willoughby and Alan Dulles. Charles Willoughby, nay Karl Adolf von Zschäpe und Wiedenbach, was a German-born fascist who was an ardent admirer of Francisco Franco and was an avowed anti-Semite. Even Douglas MacArthur viewed Charles Willoughby as a fascist. Willoughby went on to become Douglas MacArthur's G2, his chief of military intelligence, from 1939 to 1950. And he was a prominent player in the American domestic fascist scene and also a prominent player in American national security affairs. Alan Dulles, along with his brother John Foster Dulles, major partners in the Sullivan and Cromwell Wall Street law firm, was one of the American spies and diplomats and financiers and industrialists who was front and center in the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that capitalized Nazi Germany and fascist Italy to begin with. Alan Dulles then worked very closely with the Galen spy outfit in the post-World War II period. What we're going to look at first is the correspondence, a section of the correspondence between Charles Willoughby and Alan Dulles about the need to improve relations between Germans and, in particular, Germans of residual Nazi outlook and the U.S. military stationed in Germany. Turning now to Dick Russell's The Man Who Knew Too Much, of the Dulles-Willoughby correspondence in 1955, we read, "The correspondence continued throughout the year, with Willoughby offering on October 30, 1955, to aid in setting up, quote, promising social contacts, unquote, between young American servicemen stationed in Germany and their counterparts, quote, the new generation has less to remember and to resent, unquote, Willoughby wrote, suggesting that, again quoting, in American garrison towns in Germany, this approach can become the first step in developing a literary youth movement by utilizing existing Karl May clubs, unquote. Adolf Hitler, from his teenage years onward, was a devotee of the Wild West novels of Karl May, a German, that's spelled M-A-Y, a German imitator of James Fenimore Cooper. Again, quoting Willoughby, quote, from the viewpoint of social relations and youth indoctrination, unquote, Willoughby continued, again quoting, it fits neatly, as you know, into one of the many facets of psychological warfare. It could become the medium by which we can gain young adherents and partisans. Anyway, I am going to try it. However, I do not want to stand alone, though the Germans will take it up, and I suggest that you examine it from the viewpoint of a discreet penetration and the, quote, making of friends, unquote. Dulles responded with interest on November 20th, quote, I trust we may soon get together for a personal account of your conversations with the German gentleman. I have also had two very interesting meetings with them, and it might be useful to compare notes. Let me know when you are next in town, unquote. One of the two German gentlemen, unquote, mentioned by Willoughby in his previous letter was General Hans Speidel, or Speidel, S-P-E-I-D-E-L, chief of staff for Nazi Field Marshal Erwin Rommel during the latter stages of World War II. And I would add that by the late 1950s, Hans Speidel had become the commander of all ground forces in Western Europe for NATO. And again, he was one of the contacts that, again, these two prominent American fascists, Charles Willoughby and Alan Dulles, were trying to develop in Germany. And as I've noted in the October 4th, 1992 installment of RFA 37, and in the 13-part series Reunited Germany, The New Danger, not only was Germany never denazified, but its armed forces and intelligence service were simply handed down from those of the Third Reich. There are indications, again, that the efforts of Dulles and Willoughby were quite successful. I've spoken in the past about the Schmidt brothers, including Larry Schmidt, spelled S-C-H-M-I-D-T. Larry Schmidt headed up an organization called CUSA, or Conservatism USA, which appears to have been involved in several aspects of the assassination of President Kennedy. And this organization of an explicitly fascist outlook was put together when Schmidt was stationed in Germany in the army. Turning once again to The Man Who Knew Too Much by Dick Russell. Immediately after Walker departed Munich, that's Major General Edwin Walker, Schmidt began quietly organizing his CUSA crusade within the U.S. military there. Schmidt, whose admitted hero was Hitler's propaganda chief, Joseph Goebbels, had apparently scored an organizing coup d'etat. And still more about Schmidt and CUSA. Schmidt had served two army tours of duty in West Germany, and though he was not a native Texan, came to Dallas straight from Munich after receiving his discharge. He had already mapped out plans in West Germany for an organization called CUSA, code for Conservatism USA. By June 1962, Schmidt had signed up several zealots in West Germany inside the military police and the counterintelligence corps. As Look magazine later described it, Schmidt, quote, had trained a small, disciplined band of soldier conspirators to follow him stateside, and do, he hoped, whatever is necessary to accomplish our goal, unquote. That goal was to infiltrate right-wing groups across the United States and weld them into CUSA with the grand design of taking control of American politics. Schmidt's plan was to gain financial support from wealthy supporters such as Dallas's H.L. Hunt family. By the way, I would add that the Hunt family, including Nelson Bunker Hunt, were deeply involved with an international intelligence network put together by the aforementioned Charles Willoughby called the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture. That's discussed at considerable length in RFA 37, specifically in the July 26th and August 2nd editions of RFA 37. More about what is going on in Germany and in Europe. Germany's been rattling sabers with regard to the ongoing Balkans War, something that Germany precipitated when it bludgeoned the rest of the European community into recognizing the secession of Slovenia and Croatia from the Yugoslav Federation. Initially, the EC had been opposed to that secession, but Germany basically twisted their arms into going along with that, and the United States and George Bush then backed Germany. The following is from the San Jose Mercury News website, the Mercury Center. This is from the Mercury News of Tuesday, September 22nd of 1998. It's an AP story, Dateline the United Nations, headlined, Germany Threatens Force in Kosovo. Germany threatened Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic with military force today if he doesn't loosen his grip on the separatist province of Kosovo, saying NATO was prepared to act to resolve the crisis. In a speech to world leaders gathered for the General Assembly, German Foreign Minister Klaus Kinkel condemned the use of force by Milosevic's men and the Kosovo Liberation Army. The KLA is fighting for independence for Kosovo, where ethnic Albanians make up 90% of the population. As we've noted in, among other programs, our interviews with Martin Lee, and as is documented in the book The Beast Reawakens, Germany was inextricably was the prime player not only in the breakup of Yugoslavia, but also in the breakup of Czechoslovakia as well, with the Hans Steidl Stiftung being the major element in that. That's discussed in the four interviews with Martin Lee that are available from Spitfire and in Martin Lee's remarkable book The Beast Reawakens, published by Little Brown in 1997. And apparently Germany is very active through the BND and German military intelligence in the former Yugoslavia and has been channeling weaponry to the aforementioned Kosovo Liberation Army, which has been at loggerheads with the Serbs in what used to be Yugoslavia. Research credit to a listener on each of the following articles from the vitally important Germany Alert newsletter. This is from Germany Alert from... this would be November 9th of 1998, and this is, and this again is from Germany Alert. German weapons shipments to Albania revealed, and Germany Alert can be found on the web. Their address is germany.alert.com, and again, you can find that on the World Wide Web. And again, this is from the latest edition of Germany Alert. This is entitled German Weapons Shipments to Albania Revealed, and this reads, German weapons have been sent since 1990 to the Albanian government, according to a report on German television. The Monitor program also reported that the German military, the Bundeswehr, conducts joint exercises with the Albanian military, which is known to fund and supply the Albanian separatist army, the UCK. German weapons have also been found with UCK fighters, including the Armbrust anti-tank grenade launcher developed for the Bundeswehr by weapons manufacturer MBB. According to the news magazine Program, the German BND has had a legal residence in Tirana since 1990. Monitor quoted a source as saying, quote, in 1990 through 91, German military intelligence, or MAD, repeatedly delivered electronic and optical observation and radio equipment to the Albanian intelligence service. The observation equipment came from East German leftover Stasi equipment. German military intelligence officials trained the Albanian intelligence officials in the use of this equipment. Albanian intelligence has transferred the German-supplied equipment and weapons to the Albanian separatist army, the UCK, in Kosovo. The German Defense Ministry denies MAD supplies were sent to Albania, but Monitor quotes several sources from the BND and from the MAD Section 3 who witnessed the training. So German arms now finding their way to the Kosovo Liberation Army, further fracturing what used to be Yugoslavia. And again, bear in mind, when I read the book Serpent's Walk, I recognized several elements of truth. The German army was never effectively denazified, and as discussed in a recent half-hour segment that invited convicted Nazi terrorist Manfred Raeder to lecture to the elite German officers' academy, and there are indications that the scenario presented in Serpent's Walk was already well underway by the mid-1950s, with the recruiting of American service personnel stationed in Germany to the fascist cause. And again, I do not believe that Serpent's Walk is fiction. More from the Germany Alert newsletter. This is from Germany Alert of October 8th of 1998. Neo-Nazi thugs attack U.S. soldier in Bavaria at state-lined Bonn. German neo-Nazi skinheads have stepped up their campaign of hate and fear with a new wave of attacks, one of them a 21-year-old U.S. soldier stationed in Germany. In what was described as a brutal onslaught, the soldier was beaten on his head, on his face, and all over his body, unquote, by a gang of 24 neo-Nazis. Apparently he was not among those recruits. I was guardedly optimistic that the recent election of the Schröder government, a center-left government in Germany, would serve as something of a break to the slide of Germany into fascism. Sadly, at least with regard to German interior politics, internal politics, that does not appear to be on the horizon. Research credit on the following, again, goes to a listener. This is from Germany Alert, and this is from Wednesday, November 18th of 1998. And this is Germany Alert of November, this is datelined Bonn, November 19th of 1998. It's entitled, Chile Police, Not Justice, Should Fine Citizens for Minor Crimes. Interior Minister Otto Schily, S-C-H-I-L-Y, seems intent upon marching Germany further and further from democratic principles. In his latest proposal, Schily would toss out the separation of powers between police and justice so the German police could, without any procedure, judge, or jury impose fines upon citizens for minor crimes. The Greens, partners in the government coalition, were aghast. Socialists from the PDS were scathing in their condemnation of the plan. Even a few social Democrats and a spokesperson for the police labor union burst out in criticism. And still more about the repressive policies that are being either introduced and or endorsed and furthered by the new interior minister of the Schroeder government. Again, from Germany Alert, November 18, 1998, Dateline to Bonn headlined, harsh criticism of government's anti-immigration stance. Hopes that the newly elected Social Democrat government would reverse Germany's blatantly anti-foreigner policies have been dashed. Instead, Interior Minister Otto Schily has offered strident anti-immigration comments that have enraged non-Germans and unleashed a chorus of harsh criticism from the Greens and Socialist PDS, but have won praise from the rightist Christian Democrats, the CDU-CSU. In an interview with the Berlin Tagesspiegel of November 15th, Schily asserted that the boundary of acceptable stress caused by immigrants has been, quote, exceeded, unquote, and that Germany has reached the, quote, maximum limit, unquote, of foreigners. Again, about a political battle cry very similar to what one is hearing in the United States today. And by the way, we're also seeing a broad and terrifying expansion of search procedures in the United States as well. That is also continuing in Germany. More about what Interior Minister Otto Schily has on his agenda. Again, from Germany Alert, this is Dateline November 17, 1998. Dateline Berlin and headlined, Police allowed to be searching without suspicion. Interior Minister Otto Schily has called for German police to receive sweeping new powers that would enable them to search individuals and property even when there are no grounds to suspect criminal activity. Legislation allowing the broad new police powers is expected to get strong support from both the ruling Social Democrats and opposition Christian Democrats, spokespersons for the parties said Monday. And in one of the most terrifying of the articles from Germany Alert, this is from Germany Alert's issue again of November 9th of 1998. We have the following about the expansion of Nazi cultism and lifestyle among German youth in some of the new German states. That presumably alludes to East Germany, although this is, appears to be going on in some parts of West Germany as well. This is an article by Brenda Williams. It's a Germany Alert special report headlined, Soaring Nazi Movement, The New Lifestyle of Hate, subtitled, The Rise of Extreme Hate Among Youth in Eastern Germany Has Mushroomed into a Terrifying Culture. And it reads in part, Right-wing extremism as a lifestyle? That's an heretical thought, but it can explain many phenomena in the new German states where traditional political frameworks only inadequately take hold or do not take hold at all. Right-wing extremism in everyday life today can no longer be understood by just asking questions about political parties and organizations, number of members, and election results. Here, a worldly context developed from right-wing beliefs, standardized behavior among youth, and the constant preparedness for violence is on its way to becoming the norm. Without visible resistance, a type of counterculture is being created in which the ethical and humanistic values of democracy no longer have a place. Those who drive attentively through the towns will notice a monoculture, especially among young males. The right-wing extremism of the late 90s is moving from the country to the cities. The pressure in the community to conform is strong. Rejecting the prevailing right-wing views inevitably leads to exclusion and loss of social contacts. Those who have conformed are most prepared to become violent because they must constantly prove their loyalty to their clique, group, or scene. In this type of organization, where one chooses to give up one's freedom, the higher-ranking or older members in the hierarchy can often avoid showing the typical characteristics of group membership, whereas the average right-oriented, right-wing extremist youth usually go all out in their appearance, which has only slightly changed from about 15 years ago. Short haircuts, bomber jackets, combat boots, polo shirts, and T-shirts from special sports clothing manufacturers Lonsdale and Fred Perry, T-shirts printed with symbols, slogans, pictures, and band names, the choice of either Domestos pants or jeans, special color fading techniques are currently, quote, in, unquote, parts of uniforms, olive green, fall-winter camouflage, and the most varied accessories such as patches, suspenders, and baseball caps. Skipping down. In certain regions, Children already start wearing this clothing when they are 11 years old, the equivalent of fifth grade. The numbers just go up from there. The most basic similarities between students with right-wing tendencies and organized right-wing extremists is the open and aggressive practice of inequality toward people and groups of color, from which all of the hate groups stem: foreigners, those who have differing opinions, the homeless, Jews, Muslims, Christians, the handicapped, homosexuals, and members of other youth groups. The right-wing beliefs that an 11-year-old carries with him are what he has heard at the dinner table. There, after having survived the GDR system and hiding out in an internationalist disguise, nationalism raises its ugly head. Derogatory terms like Prubkole, Das Schappe, and Offenrohr, equivalent to, quote, nigger, unquote, coon, unquote, or jungle bunny, unquote, were invented in Eastern Germany to describe people of color, as was the term Fijis to describe the Vietnamese and all people considered to be Asian. The latter term has already entered into the colloquial language. It is therefore of utmost importance to warn people against describing right-wing extremism as a fringe group or a problem among youth, even if right-wing extremism is most visible as a phenomenon among youth. The manner of dress plays two roles in demonstrating their views. On the one hand, it identifies that the person belongs to a specific group. On the other, it strengthens the person's status within the group. The typical entry-level attire includes a bomber jacket, most often still green in color, and covered by a scarf from the wearer's favorite soccer team. The short haircut is only the second most important change. The third most important accessory is combat boots made by Doc Marten. Their uniform is consciously militant and is supposed to raise self-esteem, to suggest power and authority, to intimidate, and to demonstrate their willingness to attack. And skipping down still further, in addition to clothing, there are legends and myths that are passed on from generation to generation. There is a relic that is hung on from the classic days of the GDR. For example, Lonsdale t-shirts are part of the classic outfit. When the zipper on the bomber jacket or leather jacket is zipped up halfway, the letters NSDA, which stand for National Socialist German Workers, or instead of NSDAP, the National Socialist German Workers Party, appear in a triangle. This is not obvious to outsiders, but is highly symbolic to the group. In wet Eastern and Western Germany more than 10 years ago, an alleged connection was made between one's conviction and the color of one's shoelaces. The nationalists wear white, political opponents supposedly wear red, and anti-Semites or cop killers wear yellow. Whereas the initiates still treat the color of their shoelaces as a secret sign of recognition, the older members no longer see them as important. The accessories also serve two functions: political demonstration or outward provocation, and recognition and means of communication within the group. Accessories gained their current importance in the mid-80s, when punks started looking more like skinheads and acts of violence were often avoided only by giving one another certain signals. National symbols already form elements of an internal language to a degree. These symbols are, as an article on the homepage of the racist newspaper Nordische Zeitung states, quote, not just a means of communication with runes and symbols, pledges are sealed and desires are made manifest, unquote. The colors of the German Reich are the most important symbols: black, white, and red. It doesn't matter if it is the Reich flag or the naval ensign, they are only disguised symbols for the flag with a swastika, the national flag of the Third Reich. No one who carries the Reich flag at demonstrations wants to have the old Kaiser Wilhelm back again. Therefore, since the adoption of the naval ensign in the canon of regulation infringements, the black, white, red Reich's patch is emblazoned on sleeves. The so-called proud patch, I am proud to be German, is now rarely to be seen. Even the last people to wear it finally noticed that you have to be careful if you're going to wear the proud patch. At the Monday demonstrations in Leipzig in 1989, and for months thereafter, there weren't just a few comrades walking around with a patch that had the Austrian eagle in the center of the noble maxim instead of the eagle of the German Reich. Triangular patches representing different districts of authority were worn until members of the Viking Youth and the Free German Workers' Party were banned. These triangular patches were black and contained the symbol of the district in Gothic black lettering. It goes on to describe the various symbology that these German youth, German Nazi-inclined youth, wear. I alluded to many of the half-hour segments that one can check out for background on many of the topics, including Serpent's Walk, the Bormann Organization, and German corporate acquisitions in the U.S. Those are available from Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. Email spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.